Good evening, you all. K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, his name is Mel, and K2 Romeo India Whiskey, my name is Dick. Mel and Dick try to organize this slightly crazy, enthusiastic group called the Technical Net at this time, in which radio amateurs who really like to dig into the nitty-gritty of how all this stuff works, how to get it to work better, we gather for the last 27 years, most Sunday evenings at 8 o'clock on this particular repeater, and we discuss our favorite subject. Try to find out what Mother Nature is telling us, how things really work, and how to get some more enjoyment out of it. The subjects that are discussed on the Technical Net are primarily the subjects that you guys bring as questions. With a couple of rare exceptions, Mel and Dick do not supply the questions. So if you're unhappy with the subjects that are discussed, then you're unhappy with the questions that people are asking, and maybe ask your favorite question. For the most part, we're fairly lenient in that there's no such thing as a question that's too complicated or too simple. Mel and Dick usually are smart enough to admit when they don't know something, and in the tri-state area, there's a lot of brain power. In the New York City tri-state area, which means that this repeater can covers with reasonable fidelity, it covers northeastern New Jersey, southern New York State, western Long Island, southwestern Connecticut. In that area, there's a lot of brain power. Quite frequently, somebody will hear a subject being discussed. He says, hey, I know something about that. He chimes in and gives us the benefit of his wisdom. It's a kind of a peer-reviewed study going on here. We make mistakes, and in the future weeks, people point out those mistakes to us, or during the next week, they'll point out the mistakes, and we try to correct them. Nobody bats a thousand. So most of the people who sign in are smart enough to realize that they're occasionally going to make errors. And,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
You can have at least two different philosophies in life. You can spend the rest of your life defending whatever you said, saying that I really meant this, and that I'm accurate. Or you can admit that, hey, I make some errors, and when you're pushing the envelope, by definition, you're going to make errors. That's a given. Can't have it any other way. There's a risk-benefit ratio of everything you do. You're not going to get out of this life alive, if you know what I mean. there's going to be some risk on everything you do, and you have to sort of accept that. You can try to avoid as much risk as possible, but you can't avoid all of it. So that comes to what you do in your automobile, what you do on your radio tower, what you do when you're working on a high-voltage power supply, or what you do when you give an answer on the Technical Net. There's going to be errors once in a while. And got to try to be careful. A person signs into the Technical Net because they want to give us their name, their call letters, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment for the net. Last week, Joe, W-H-2-R-Y-Y, signed in, and we didn't get a chance to get to him. So when he signs in tonight, he comes near the top of the list. There's also a continuing research project going on at Wesley's house, N2XJN. So I'm sure we'll be hearing from him, and I'm going to tell you that he's automatically signed in. So he doesn't have to rush. For the other people who want to sign in, please give Mel and Dick your call letters and your name at this time. K2RIW listening.
KC2YSK, the name is Jay.
K2YRO, the name is Ray.
Okay, I got Jay, KC2YSK, Ray, YRO, something to YRO. Give me the prefix there, Ray.
That would be KC2YRO, and the name is Ray.
We got you, Ray. All right, so far we got Jay and Ray and Wesley. Who else would like to sign in? Because you have a question or a comment, you need not sign in if you're just listening. After 27 and a half years, we sort of accept the fact that there are people out there listening. So anyone else who's fairly sure they've got a question or a comment, or they think they're going to come up with one, give me your call letters and name right now.
WF2N, Paul, with a space update.
Okay, Paul, with a space update. I think there was a double. Who was signing at the same time as Paul?
Just me, K2KEY, saying good evening to all.
Pretty fine, Mel. Mel, are you running your transmitter at the high power or hearing a little bit of hiss in the background?
Right, I had it on the local repeater. Hold on. Okay, how's that?
Fantastic. Dead full quieting. Before you were 15% noise, 70 I can't do the mathematics. 85% audio. It sounded good, but now you're TFQ. Alrighty. So once again, we've got Wesley, Jay, Ray, Paul, in some particular order, Joe, if he signs in W-H-O-R-Y-Y. Anyone else? One last call for sign into the TechNet because you've got a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, there being none. Joe, are you there? W-H-O-R-Y-Y? Sounds like Joe is not.
Actually, yes, I am. And I don't think I had a question this week. You sort of surprised me.
Okay, Joe, last week you signed in. We tried to turn it over to you later on in the net, and you had been called away. You weren't there. So what was your question last week? Had we gotten to you last week, what were you going to tell us, or what were you going to ask us? You got it, Joe.
Maybe it'll come to me a little later. I really don't remember. I don't remember specifically the question. The only comment I have for you and digital television was you were complaining about channel 5, which is RF44, and RF channel 38, giving you different levels from time to time. I have noticed that my house at channel 44 is significantly down in signal strength from what it used to be. I haven't measured the analyzer yet, but it looks like signal strength as far as error rate used to be full scale, just about over time. And it's typically about maybe three-quarter scale now. Three-quarters are a little slightly higher. So there's a noticeable drop in the signal level. Maybe that's what you were experiencing lately. As far as questions, maybe it'll come to me later.
My goodness, sounds like you forgot. Thank goodness you're not over 30 years of age where people start forgetting things, Joe. And very good on the 44 and 38, the real RF frequency channel for what's locally called 5-1 and 5-2. That is their branding. And that unusual situation exists in New York City where 5-1 and 5-2 are two separate RF frequencies. Normally in digital television.
I got some answers for you.
Go ahead, Eric.
No, I spoke to a couple of folks, looked at my analyzer. Back in April, they decided there was so much confusion that what they did, the transmitter that belongs to Channel 5 at WNYW transmits 5-1 and 9-2. And the transmitter that belongs to WWOR transmits 9-1 and 5-2. So that's why the difference in frequency. They actually had to get a variant with the FCC to do that, from what I understand. Although the FCC rules they haven't rewritten them to the extent where it spells this stuff out, but it was registered with them. But don't forget that the 5-1 and the 9-2 are simply packets identifiers. They're part of what's called the Program System Information Protocol. And they decided to do that because there was confusion. So the 9-1, which is the HD channel, and the 5-1, which is their HD channel, and the sub-channels, which is 9-2, is an SD channel, a standard definition channel, and the 5-2 is also a standard definition channel, which is, in fact, simulcast. If you actually look at the piece of, it'll say NYW simulcast and WWOR simulcast. So, there you have it. K2RWK2J.
Hey, you think the life would have been a little bit simpler if 5-1 and 5-2 was one of the broadcasters like WNYW and 9-1 and 9-2 was the other. But I guess the mixture of a high def and standard def, was that part of the complicating factor? And I suspect this is a unique situation we have in New York City. I'll bet there are very few places throughout the United States where the branding 5-1 and 5-2 are two separate broadcasting entities on two separate RF frequencies. I'm guessing that's somewhat unique. So the mixture of standard definition and high def, is that part of the motivation for doing it this unusual way? Over to you, Eric.
No, negative. The reason for it is both stations, which one we call Fox and one we call MyMane, they're both owned by Rupert Murdoch. And that exists in New York, it exists in Los Angeles, I don't know if it exists in Washington, but he's actually managed to make the FCC change their rules because of all his money. Because it used to be you could only own one broadcast station in the single market. And there were laws that said you couldn't own a broadcast station and a newspaper. Now, that got changed, so, you know, make what you want of it.
One other comment I've got, Eric, and that is for people like Joe and me and Mel, we're some of the rare individuals that are watching over-the-air broadcast as opposed to cable TV. It seems to me like 98% of the population has gone to cable TV. If I drive up and down all of the streets of Huntington, I can no longer find a single roof-mounted operational aerial. And since I live 35 miles east of Manhattan, the chances of getting reception with an indoor antenna are very slim. So the fact that there are no rooftop antennas is a pretty strong indication that I'm one of the very few. I may be the only human being in the 250,000 people town of Huntington that's still using over-the-air broadcast. I'm beginning to feel a little bit like a second-class citizen. Let me drop. Because many of the channels I like to watch are not covered by my local newspaper, not well covered by Newsday or by New York Times. Maybe there's some newspaper somewhere. So that when it comes to programming schedule, the electronic programming guide is something I depend on. If I go to Channel 25, for weeks on end, maybe months, it'll give me 2 hours at a time. It'll say from 8 to 10, 10 to 12, 12 to 2, 2 to 4, 4 to 8, all the way around the clock. Always two-hour chunks are labeled as City Drive Live. That's a nice set of words. No real information. Some of the programs that go there are a half hour long. Some of them are 1 hour long. And everything is displayed in two-hour chunks. In other words, I can't figure out when a program is going to start or stop. I can't figure out what the name of the program is. I can't figure out what the program content is. I'm getting no information on the electronic programming guide. It's a phony. When it comes to channel 11-2, Australia TV, they do it differently. They do it in two-hour chunks from 1 to 3, 3 to 5, 5 to 7, and it just says Australia TV. No information of any kind. Am I the only person that's recognizing the fact that I'm a second-class citizen because I'm watching over-the-air television? Over to you, Eric. K2EJ, K2LIW.
First of all, the other people in Huntington didn't watch over the air. Secondly, the largest groups of over the air viewers are in the city. Places like Brooklyn, Queens, places where if you live in the city, chances are you're one of the people that don't have a lot of money, you live in the city, and you're not buying cable TV. Because you don't got the money for that. And you live on Long Island, you know, I don't know, maybe take a drive-through wine there into Hempstead, you'll see a lot of antennas. But as far as the program guide is concerned, in the case of WNYE, 25-2 is all New York City traffic cameras. You're aware of that, right?
Yes, I am, but a 25-1, which is sort of a PBS-like channel, has some darn good programming. I'd love to know ahead of time what's going to be when and what program so I can plan my life around it, so to speak. And the electronic programming guide gives me zero information. Over to you, Eric. Other than the fact that they're alive and well.
Okay. Typically, the stuff that gets printed in the newspaper, right, it's called the Tribune Guide Service. All the broadcast stations send their logs to Tribune, which then distributes them to newspapers and all the cable systems. If you were on cable, you'll see the cable has guides too. It really all depends upon the traffic system that the station has and how much money they wanted to spend. There is no law that says that you have to fill up the guides. The only thing you have to do is have your major and minor channel modes show up, and your guides can be empty. Now, that's the first thing. There are a number of different guide builders. One is called a Tri-Vini guide builder, which a lot of folks use. We use that at 13. And we use a traffic system called ProTrack. And what we did was we modified, or actually had them modify ProTrack to produce an XML list, which actually then goes to the Tri-Vini guide builder. And it puts all the appropriate information in the right spots. By the way, the program guide is really a cyclic buffer. And it transmits stuff in 3-hour chunks, even though it's listed as 2-hour chunks the way you see it. And a lot of them, it really depends upon the receiver. Whereas, in essence, you may have 24 or 48 hours worth of guide information that is in a circular buffer that's continuing to display itself over and over again.
The bottom line seems to be that I guess I just have to live with the situation. I think you're saying because of finances, there probably is no simple corrective action that could be applied. Is that roughly true, Eric?
No, it's really up to the station. Whereas WNYE was actually originally the Board of Ed, but the city of New York has it now. So there are a number of TV guide services that are available on the Internet that have full listing. So, you know, you're not stuck if you have a computer.
Okay. Are these a paid service, or is there a freeware Internet? If so, give me your website.
There's several websites. One is TV Guide, actually. And if I turn my computer on, I can tell you what the other ones are. I have a few of them.
It's APG with info.
Go right ahead. Dave?
The one I use, and I have sent you an email, it's Titan TV. I think it's titantv.com. You can set it up for over-the-air broadcast. You pick out your, you know, your viewing location. You want the New York City stations, or you'd like the Connecticut stations, whatever you like. And you just punch it up, and it, you know, it gives you the all the programs. You can set it up for tomorrow or next week or last week and what time you want. It's pretty good.
That's good to know. I believe you're of the same philosophy as Mel and I and Joe, and that is I think you primarily watch over-the-air broadcast television as opposed to cable television in your house in Massapequa. Is that roughly true, Dave?
Yeah, that's all I got. Got the antenna on the roof, and, you know, it's what we got. It's what we like.
Yeah, I must be cheap. it's just some kind of a psychological thing. The fact that I can watch television from a whole lot of states. I've got a high location, a tower, and I used to have an antenna on the tower. I got to restore it, and so I can watch television from long distances. And I'd like to start doing what Joe's been doing, television DXing on digital television with a nice directive antenna with a rotator. I'm getting the impression that those people who watch over-the-air broadcast television, digital television, there is a strong requirement for a rotator. Even though you may have line of sight to Empire State Building and you think you're always going to get a signal that's ground gangbusters, I'm one of those. I'm getting strong signals. The trouble is the digital television converter is very non-tolerant of co-channel interference. When I start getting a signal from Hartford, which is, again, almost line of sight from me, and I get that simultaneous on the same frequency as a New York City station, my converter just says, forget it, ain't nothing there. I can't make sense of that, is what my Radio Shack converter will say. And my guess is there wouldn't be a great deal of difference when it comes to co-channel interference survival without a rotator, no matter what I was using. If I had a really expensive gold-plated digital television as opposed to a separate top box converter, my guess is my vulnerability to co-channel interference would be fairly similar. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Well, believe it or not, the newer converters or the newer sets that have the fifth and now coming seventh generation equalizers, you can actually play a little game with them. Whichever signal is a little bit stronger because the symbols are never synchronous with each other. We're talking about nanoseconds. You can play a little game with it. So if you rotate your antenna slightly off and one of the code channels is a little bit stronger with some of the newer equalizers, it's going to lock up. It's interesting.
Yeah, my buddy Kent, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Julia Bravo, is convinced by way of his access to broadcast engineers and people who were heavily involved in the testing of the Advanced Television Selection Committee, ATSC, the digital television. He was convinced that all adjacent channels have to be within 3 hertz of differential accuracy on what I call their pilot tone. And Joe, the B2RYY, supplied to us a carefully measured data where the offsets on channels can be much, much greater. Numbers like tens of hertz and maybe even hundreds of hertz. So when it comes to frequency accuracy...
I can explain that.
Yeah, go right ahead. I was about to ask, is the frequency accuracy, if it was being achieved, would that help the co-channel interference problem? KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2RYW in the TechNet.
K2RYW, KE2EJ. There was a time where there was a fixed offset, and that was when we were transmitting analog and digital. It was called N plus 1. I don't remember the exact number, but... it's a couple hundred hertz difference. And the reason for that was is to prevent adjacent sound carriers and stuff like that from banging into the digital signal, or the other way around, I forget. It's completely out of my mind at this point because it's been a year already, so I'm not even thinking about it. Some digital transmitters are connected to a GPS oscillator, which creates 10 megahertz, which guarantees that it's exactly within, I think it's within 2 hertz of where the heck it's supposed to be. But there are many transmitters that use their own internal oscillators, and they're supposed to be accurate, but as you know, crystals are crystals, and they're not quite as close as you think they ought to be. And, of course, these are type-accepted and approved broadcast transmitters, so I don't know how to give you why, but it just is.
Turns out that Kent thought that there was an FCC requirement to be within 3 hertz. I think you're saying there is no such requirement that you know of. Is that true, Eric?
No, I think the rules, you know what? Give me about 5 minutes. I'll read you the rule. Yes, there is a requirement, but it just ain't the way it is. That's all.
Most likely is some number of parts per million or parts per billion of frequency accuracy. But one last question on this one, Eric. To your knowledge, if the adjacent channels or the co-channels were within 3 hertz as opposed to, let's give me a number, 150 hertz of separation, would that make the tolerance of co-channel interference signal amplitude, instead of minus 25 dB, it can tolerate minus 7 dB? I mean, is there some kind of an advantage the adapting converter function would have if there was greater frequency accuracy between the co-channels? Over to you, Eric.
So the long and short of it is that the decoders in the converter really don't care about frequency that much. They don't. They just find and separate the clock signal that is then the, you know, because this is an asynchronous system, they get the clock pulse and starts counting from that. So as long as it separates what we call the data sync from the trellis, I have to go into a whole bunch of things, but it starts there. The pilot, as quote-unquote, is really not necessary for decoding or extracting the data. So once you get the clock pulse and then you count X number of periods, you'll know that the first header is going to be the first packet of data. Actually, I can pull out the book and I can give you the details. And then the next header of that packet of data is going to say what kind of data it is, whether it's video data, audio data, PZIP data, extended guide table data, TVCT data, which says what channel and what PZIP number or transmission identification number it is. And by the way, every station actually has its own unique PZIP number. It's kind of like packet radio, except it's just not little bits of your call sign and whatever text you're writing. It's a particular header number and a packet of 188 bytes of video data and another header number and 188 bytes of audio data, etc.
Okay, let me give you one piece of information that I ran across. Assume now I know this is a clock signal that the converter is really looking for, but for simplistic reasons, let me assume that the clock signal that it locks everything to is really the pilot tone. I know it might not be. Assume now I've got two co-channel signals, digital television signals. One of them is stronger than the other by, let me pick a number, 7 decibels. And the two of them are offset by, let me pick a number, 150 hertz. If I put an ideal frequency counter on that system, I would measure in long-term counting the exact frequency of the stronger signal. However, if I now aligned a phase lock loop system to that pilot tone, and I study the ideal phase lock loop system, I would see that the phase coming out would be the right number of cycles per second, but the instantaneous phase would wave back and forth by some number of degrees, maybe 15 or 20 degrees, waving back and forth 150 times per second. The weaker signal, although it's not changing the count, and it's not changing the exact long-term frequency coming out of the oscillator, it is making its presence known by waving the instantaneous phase of this ideal phase lock loop. As such, when that instantaneous phase is waving back and forth, does that aggravate the proper operation of the decoding process? KE2EJ, K2LIW, SICKNET.
K2RW, K2J. Well, it's all a matter of time, actually, rather than frequency. How can I explain this? This is a good one. How you extract a clock, which is then going to extract the data from whatever signals, whatever pulses are preceding it, is going to be used as the master oscillator, let's call it that, in the the master flywheel that has cogs in it. And every time one of those cogs lines up with a data bit, or what it thinks is a data bit, it's going to extract it. So if your flywheel is exactly in phase with the data that's coming, it's going to decode that data. You can have data on the same frequency that's in the teeth of the cogs rather than in the spaces of the cogs, and it's going to ignore that data. If you can change the phase of the flywheel, you literally can take the other station that's on the same frequency and extract that data. Does that kind of make sense to you?
Yeah, when it comes to the particular periods of time in which you're doing the coding of specific pieces of information, and that you get some nice correlation when your master clock has the proper timing. And the data that falls in between the cogs is digitally, deprocessing speaking, orthogonal data. It doesn't add up correctly as far as the demodulating process is concerned. But now my master clock has to be properly timed. Properly timed really means in phase and on the correct frequency. And if the phase is waving back and forth because of this co-channel problem and frequency difference, the timing is waving back and forth. That seems to me that the degree of orthogonality between the desired and the undesired data to be demodulated is now also waving back and forth. So I'm getting the gut feel that there could be some degradation created by the timing error, created by the cyclic phase shift of the co-channel off-center frequency. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, let me throw another variable in here. We have something called a PCR clock, called a phase-controlled reference. every transmitter, every exciter in the transport stream, because there's different layers of streams, like, sort of like Ethernet. You have a transport layer, which contains data that also has what we call elementary data within it. This transport layer, or this stream, forget about frequency of the carrier, this transport stream is actually driven by a phase lock loop that has phase jitter. So, not only do you have the frequency aspect of it, but you have the phase data error within the data itself. So, that makes it that much more complicated. You know what? I'm going to go pull out the book because I want to give you a clear answer on this.
Now, Joe, recognize, stand by a second. For those who are not interested in digital television, we're going to hop off this subject right now, and I know that Wesley is patiently waiting. He's mailed me. Let's go over to Joe for a brief discussion of what he wanted to say. Then we're going to hop off this subject, go over to Wesley's subject for a while, and then at 9 o'clock we better go over to the younger people who sign in emails to Mel, and then we'll come back to all this much later tonight. So take your time on the research you're about to do, Eric. We shouldn't dwell too long on this particular subject. It is a little bit deep for some people who are not quite interested in it. W2RYY, what do you think is going on here, Joe? K2RYW and the tech man.
Okay, let me just tell you about what happened about a week or so ago when the band was opened up pretty good. I had my antenna pointed at 275 to 280 degrees azimuth, and I was getting channel 7 from New York, and it was actually coming and going. The picture would pixelate every once in a while. I watched the signal strength meter with it, what you call, I guess, a bit error rate meter, go between, say, 3/4 scale to 1/4 scale, then it would get picture would go out a lot. Went to my R7000 and listened on that frequency with a monitor antenna, and I was getting a distinctive 150 hertz pitch between two different carriers on 174.3094. And of course, being like you, I had to find where it was coming from. And I eventually did find out where it was coming from. The other channel 7 I was picking up was WHRE, RF channel 7, DT21, and it was somewhere around Virginia, North Carolina, borderline. And it was interesting. I could pick that station up completely, and I'd lock right up on it without any interference from New York if I put my antenna at 205 degrees. To be able to get channel 7 from WABC from New York successfully all the time without any picture pixelation, I had to put my antenna at 295 to 300 degrees, which normally I keep it at 280.
My guess is when you aimed at a little bit further north, when you thought you were aiming toward New York City, you were really steering one of the nulls of your antenna pattern at the North Carolina, Virginia area, and therefore nulling out WHRE. For those who used to do television DXing, the modern day equivalent is what Joe is doing. He's now doing digital long distance television DXing. And he's got, by my standards, somewhat modest equipment. His rotator plus antenna is mounted on the chimney of his house. A person who really wants to go flat out with the, put up 100 feet of tower and put the antenna on the top, maybe with a preamplifier, and really find out what can be happening. There used to be an organization that probably it still exists that published a yearly journal. It was called the Worldwide Television DX Association. Worldwide Television DX Association, I think is what it was called. And they used to publish this beautiful guide where on each individual page they showed you every one of the channels on channel 2 throughout the United States, every one of the channels on 3 and 4 and so on. All of their specific information about the height above average terrain, effective isotropic radiated power, affiliation, network affiliation, what kind of programming they have, lots of good information, and whether or not they were 25 KC or is it 5 KC high, low, or on frequency, and that offset of frequencies. We used to think the television DXs were done so that a person could count the number of bars across the screen when you're getting co-channel interference, and therefore, by the number of bars, know what was the frequency difference between the real channel and the co-channel, and that gave you a very strong clue as to which one of the possible locales, like was it Chicago or was it Missouri, is where you were getting that co-channel long-distance signal from. So that offset gave that information. I imagine the offset was really, let me drop. I'm guessing the offset was done for a whole lot of other reasons. Okay, I'm going to temporarily leave this subject. We're going to come back to it later because over the air television DX and high definition television broadcast and whatever is one of the subjects that a certain number of the hardcore people get a great kick out of it, as you can tell. I know it's not everybody's subject. Wesley is establishing this significant laboratory on Andrew Avenue in New York City, in Queens, New York. He's gathered quite a bit of test equipment, and he's testing a concept somewhat similar to what Mr. Tesla used to do way back at the turn of the century. You may or may not know that Tesla was one of the first people who had a patent on wireless radio long before Mr. Marconi. Everyone thinks that radio is Marconi and an invention. Well, a lot of people were involved, and Tesla was heavily involved in it. So Wesley is assembling test equipment and pieces of apparatus, somewhat like Tesla's apparatus, but with much more modern hardware being used. Let me drop. And I think it was about 7:50 or so tonight, you sent me an email, and I gave it a quick look. Not all of the graphics come through on my Linux system, unfortunately, but enough of them were there that I'm getting some of the points of the discussions that you would like to open up. One of the things that Wesley is doing is looking for techniques that give higher efficiency and or excess energy. I've got a number of suggestions along those lines, but before I make my guesses and speculations, let me go over to your specific question tonight, Wesley. N2XJN. The man with the laboratory, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. I'm doing Jan. How is my signal?
Beautiful. And I've been listening to you doing some experiments where you're 5 KC high or right on, and nowadays right on gives good audio. The so-called multipath-like effect of distorted audio has not been there for the last week or two. And I guess there's been some speculation as to whether or not when you tuned your particular transmitter 5 KCI, was it really 5 KCI? Because your signal on the input is quite strong in my house, I measured your input frequency. And when you said you were 5 KCI, you were somewhere between 4.9 and 5.1 KCI, if you know what I mean. So your frequency accuracy of your rig is not in question. And when I listened to you on the input, there was never the distortion that we were hearing through the machine. So there's some kind of peculiar propagation. Maybe your particular antenna with the reflections of the buildings in your particular neighborhood just happened to create a crazy kind of multipath into this particular repeater. And Wi-Fi KC offset makes it go away. I've got a guess on that one, but it's a little bit complicated. But sound good. Please proceed. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Music. I have sent you this particular material because I believe it's really something very much exciting. Now, let me give you a little bit of background. The Vladimir Yudkin is a member of Russian Academy of Science, and I have spoken to him today. I have spoken to him yesterday. I saw his coil, and I was a little bit shy because I was talking to this guy and he treats me like somebody big and I'm just nobody comparing to him. Anyhow, this material actually starts from Nikola Tesla, and it takes into consideration the simplest and well-known example of Michael Faraday of unipolar motor modified by Tesla. And then what actually he did is he cut the disc into spirals, and he was actually experimenting with that, but this is not what I'm going to talk about. I have sent you this, the text and the schematics of what I was talking about last time on the TechNet. So if you are able to open up on the page 3, the pages are not numbers, no, the T. I don't know if it's how it comes at your place. And then you see the capacitor, and then you see from the top to the bottom, the capacitor is horizontally. You see the induction field, which is going down, and on the right-hand side, you see the magnetic field that's from the inductance. You put the coil in that particular spot, and you connect that coil into that capacitor. What's going to happen is...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Wow. I time up the repeater. Okay. Another drawing that I have is that you have two coils. One is clockwise, the other is counterclockwise, and this shows like there's two discs in between them, which is only the imaginary capacitor. The capacitor does not exist physically. It's the capacitor. And then you go to another one, which actually shows how the magnetic field is being stretched. And then you have on another drawing, you have the shows the amplifying Tesla coil and the kicking coil and the mechanism in which it rules. And then you have the kicking process in magnetic coil. Now, I gotta say it. Everybody's gonna love this point. Let's laugh.
You're a strong enough guy, Wesley, that even if somebody says a derogatory remark, the worst derogatory remark I can think of, somebody says, hey, this is junk science. There is no such thing as junk science. If you've got reasonably well-calibrated instrumentation and are making honest measurements, no matter how crazy it may seem, you're doing science. There is no such thing as junk science. The only real junk science is when somebody doctors the data and reports things that are absolutely not true, and he makes things that are untruthful and files a report. And each time somebody does that, and he's foolish enough to do it in a peer-reviewed journal, it's only a small amount of time until somebody says, hey, I did the exact same experiment in my laboratory, and I got these different results. What's going on? Let me see your laboratory. And then the guy will go into the defensive mode and say, no, I'm not going to show you my laboratory. Then you know what's going on. So that's the only real junk science, a person who is lying or insincere, a person really making measurements. Even if the measurement does not yield what you want as a result, and if you're smart enough not to throw out the so-called outdated, quite often you'll be amazed. Somebody has got a fixed idea in his mind. He's positive he's going to do this experiment. He's going to get this result, and occasionally he gets some other result. He says, well, that's just a mistake. It's an error in the measurement, and he throws out the data. Well, that person is being foolish. There is no such thing as bad data once you figure out what's really going on. Let me drop one other point I want to make. Now, one of the interesting experiments I did, I was doing it with a capacitor, not with a coil, but the phenomena is the same. And many people have trouble with this one, but eventually you realize what's going on. If I had a capacitor that consists of two plates with some amount of area and some amount of space in between the two plates, by the formula capacitance in picofarads equals 0.225 A over T. A is area, T is thickness of the airspace between the two. You can estimate the number of picofarads. You know how to measure capacitance and calculate it. If I charge that capacitor and then move the two plates further apart while it is charged, common sense would lead you to believe I'm going to a lower capacitance. Without a doubt, you are. You're increasing the thickness between the two plates. The capacitance is decreasing. But there was a charge there, and you have not supplied any method by which the charge can leak away. So the number of coulombs of charge, call it the number of electrons, are still there. But those electrons, the exact same number of electrons, are now across the capacitor of a smaller number of picofarads. Therefore, the voltage increases. It's kind of crazy. Without doing anything to a charge capacitor, you lower the capacitance by mechanical means, among others, and the voltage increases. Since stored energy is a function of 1/2 CV squared, if I separate the plates by doubling the distance, I half the capacitance, the voltage will double. The charge has been preserved, because charge is QV. Q equals CV. Capacitance times voltage is charge. I got the same amount of charge before I separated the capacitor as after I separated the capacitor. However, kinetic energy, stored energy, not stored charge, stored energy is 1/2 CV squared. The new higher voltage, twice the higher voltage on half the amount of picofarads, is twice...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
is twice the amount of energy, 1/2 CV². So I have more joules of energy on that exact same capacitor. I didn't put any kind of a load resistor on it. I didn't add any more charge to the capacitor. All I did was to reach in there, separate the two with an insulated tool. I separated the two capacitors, and the voltage increases. The total amount of energy increases. I've physically done that experiment. When I take my Van de Graaff generator, which consists of these two very large balls, one of them gets charged with a high voltage B+, the other one is grounded, and I separate them by a certain distance, and I put a high voltage meter between the two. I own an electrostatic voltmeter that can measure 35,000 volts. So I charge them up to, let me pick a number, 25,000 volts. I connect the leads to the two spheres, turn off the machine that's charging them, and then reach over there and take the grounded sphere and pull it further away from the charged sphere. And I watch the electrostatic voltmeter go from 25 to 35,000 volts. I watch it increase. And I say, gee, that's interesting. And the total amount of energy increases. But there's a catch. Because there is charge on those two plates and a difference in potential voltage, the plates are attracting each other. There's a force being exerted by the two plates. It's electrostatic attraction. When I separated those plates, I did physical labor. I applied a force to a distance, separating those plates. That's where the excess energy came from. I supplied it. Now let me go one step further. Come here up. Assume now I have an inductor and a capacitor across each other as a resonant network. Assume that the resonant network is resonating at, let me pick a number, 1 MHz. And if I do it with the right phase angle, I'm reaching in there, I've got some kind of a machine. It could be a director capacitor. I could do it at a lower frequency. But by some means, I cyclically change the capacitance on the capacitor of this 1 MCycle resonant LC circuit. If I do it at the right timing, I'm cyclically increasing and decreasing the capacitor during the sine wave of signal that's on the LC network. I put some energy in there. The oscillation is ringing back and forth. Ordinarily, it would ring down. But I reach in there, and I cyclically change the capacitance. By mechanic means, by electronic means, doesn't matter. I can now make the ring down of voltage ring up, which is similar to one of the diagrams you just showed me, which I think is on page 3 of the document you just sent me. That's called parametric amplification. If I did that with what's called a parametric amplifier, I can be taking a signal coming down the antenna, put it into my simple-looking LC network, which just happens to have a varactor diode in there, and if the pump frequencies are right, I get amplification. So I can cyclically change the capacitance magnitude in picofarads or microfarads. Conversely, I could be squeezing and stretching the coil. I could be cyclically changing the amount of inductance of the coil. And instead of the energy ringing down, it will ring up. It gets stronger. But the energy required to do that, I supplied it. In my experiment, when I separated those two spheres, I did physical labor. That's how the energy increased. So far, the experiments I've done suggest that conservation energy is not being The experiments I've done suggest that conservation of energy is not being violated. But still, could you now make a machine where you take the output of a generator, feed it into a motor, take the mechanical output of the motor, use it to feed the generator, and now by connecting the coils, magnetic coils, the capacitors, and whatever, with the right kind of co-phase and anti-phase technique, something called a kick coil. I haven't read enough now to really know what the kick coil is doing. But if that kick coil was being fed external energy and cyclically changing capacitance, voltage, inductance, whatever, I could make the circuit ring up. But it takes another source of energy to do that. And can we do this in a way to give us excess energy output compared to what was normally there? As you can tell, I'm a little bit skeptical, but in the process of you making these measurements, you're going to pin down the exact things of what's going on.
Well, I have to add something.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, at the end of this material, Vladimir stated that he has made the model of mechanical equivalent of asymmetric transformer. And he actually found that he found that the lenses law was violated in this area. You can read that, and you can understand. In Russia, there is no room for error, and there is no room for mystic. If you publish something and it has a weak link, you're gonna be eaten alive. That's the way it is, because the level of the science over there and the competition that is there is simply working this way. And he published that material. Now, I gotta admit something. You ready, guys? I didn't want that. I spoke to John, I spoke to Eric, I didn't want to say that. Okay. Remember the thing when the last time I told you that there is an effect of memory. When you have a capacitor, the first impulse is not done yet. The part of the energy is still memorized. And then another cycle is coming. And then another cycle is coming. I was able to burn 150 watt bulb driving with it from 2.75 watts. I saw it, that's why I invested enormous amount of money on my laboratory after that I saw it. Now, there is another moment in here, the sloppy job, what Eric said is the sloppy job. But the sloppy job, I believe, was the case in which I was able to get this result. The Pitelar pancake coil may be the best decision. The voltage between neighboring windings is in inductances is very low, and then generates energy additionally not so very good. So there is a need to raise the voltage between neighboring winds in the inductance. The pancake coil or the sloppy coil, when you don't have the even, it's like you took the bunch of wires together. That's what I had on the coil. I had exactly the same schematic that is shown on one of the pages, probably page 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I had two coils, one clockwise, one anti-clockwise, and they were connected together. You don't have to believe it. I'm not afraid to be under the scrutiny. Back to you, Andres.
Yeah, fascinating. I better study this a little bit more. I've only had a chance to see it for a couple of minutes. One of the factors that's somewhat close to what I think you're talking about, Eric has probably done it. I did it in my youth. I'm sure that Mel did it. We used to have a great amount of fun in our youth when we first started studying electronics to take a oil-filled, high-voltage capacitor, say, for instance, 8 microfarads at 1,500 volts, charge it up, and put a screwdriver across the two very heavy terminals on that oil-filled capacitor. You get a very large bang, like a firecracker. You rip a chunk out of the screwdriver that you're using, and you do the experiment a few more times in a row, and you smell some ozone. It's a real fun thing to do. It's a little bit dangerous because, in the worst case, you might create some bubbles inside the oil-filled capacitor, and it might burst the case. But I think it would bulge out a long time before you would get to that effect, and you'd probably know about it. So we've done that experiment. However, one of the things that Eric, Mel, Dick, and others have experienced is that you put the screwdriver across the capacitor for the 10th time, and you discharge the capacitor, and you really leave the screwdriver there for a couple of seconds. We didn't do it, but I'm convinced that if I put my voltmeter across the two terminals, I'd measure 0 volts. I'd really discharge that capacitor. You put the screwdriver down on the bench, you go do something else, and a half hour later you come back, and you go to pick up that oil-filled capacitor, and if you make the mistake of putting your hand across the two terminals, you get a shock. The capacitor found a way of recharging itself. And exactly what's going on inside, how it does that, I'm not sure. It's some kind of a memory effect. So capacitors, at least oil-filled capacitors, high-voltage ones, have some kind of a crazy memory effect. And maybe you're using that effect in a co-phase manner to increase energy. I'm making
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout.
The place moved it.
What was that again, Eric? Go ahead.
When you watch the cap, the plates straight together. After a little period of time, the plates go back to their normal phasing.
There's a darn many plates inside that oil filled capacitor, Eric. There's such a small fixed volume in there. And I discharge it to 0 volts. Changing the spacing between the plates can allow me to take a charge that's there and increase the amount of voltage and eventually the amount of stored energy. But I can't change the charge. But I'm not convinced that that's the effect. I think there's something funny going on with the dielectric material that you thought you discharged it, but it really has some local little areas of where charge still remained.
Yeah, well, don't forget that most of these oil-filled capacitors, and that, it's two pieces of aluminum that maybe when you unroll it, it's, you know, like 20 or 30 feet long, and it's rolled up and immersed in oil. There's a lot of static potential in the dielectric material.
Okay, but when I put the screwdriver across the capacitor and I really bring it down to 0 volts, where do you believe the mysterious charge is being held at that time before I remove that screwdriver? Back to you, Eric.
Here's the thing. When you discharge it, the plates actually squeeze themselves together because we're discharging it at a high rate. Now, I actually had somebody explain this to me before. But the actual action of the plates going back here, and we're talking thousands of an inch here, but don't forget, it's like 20 feet long. So the actual separating of the plates in the dielectric material creates that static charge. It's kind of like taking a glass rod and rubbing it against something.
All right, that may explain it. When the high voltage is on the plates, because of the way the plates are rolled, I think most of these plates are double-sided. In other words, if I studied 100 rolls, so to speak, and I'm looking at layer number 50, the upper side of that layer is positive, the lower side is negative. That's how the adjacent foil, so to speak, has those other polarities. So when voltage is on the whole capacitor, all of those plates, the adjacent plates, have opposite polarity. They're all attracted to each other. So the major shrinking of the plate is going to take place while the voltage is there. When I discharge it and I remove that attractive force, the whole roll is now going to relax, and I think you're telling me the whole roll expands to a larger diameter. I sort of accept that. But if I brought it down to 0 volts, at a small diameter, and now because it's relaxed, it slowly goes to a larger diameter and sucks up some oil in between or whatever, I'm still not seeing the mechanism by which a 0-volt capacitor with a changing spacing between the plates can suddenly create brand new voltage. It seems like it's an overly efficient bootstrapping operation. Over to you, Eric.
Well, my understanding of it is that the dielectric material is basically paper that's impregnated in wax. And in essence, the movement, okay, because when you discharge it, the thing actually squeezes, the two aluminum plates literally squeeze together because of the rapid discharge, because you've got that current flowing through it. As it relaxes, you create a static charge by sort of like, think of it as the paper material itself is getting fatter, and that making it fatter is actually creating loose electrons, let's say. Again, it's kind of like rubbing dissimilar materials together.
Okay, I've got another problem now. When I discharge it with a screwdriver, I'm discharging this tremendous number of joules of energy on this capacitor, and I'm doing it in microseconds or milliseconds. And yes, huge currents are flowing in there. There are people, and I'll bet your Mel has done this one, who discharge a high voltage capacitor with a bleeder resistor. Like, say, for instance, 10,000 ohms. They put the bleeder resistor across the capacitor. They wait a minute or two and truly discharge the capacitor. Then they remove the bleeder resistor, go do something else for half an hour, and come back, and a certain amount of voltage is back on the capacitor. even though it was discharged in a very controlled manner through a bleeder resistor. Now back to you, Eric.
No, I don't have an answer for that because I haven't experienced that, but